KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hi, I'm from North Beach.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live at 24th and Valencia.
I live in the Outer Sunset.
Coming up, Bay Area colleges and universities struggle to keep their students in secure housing. So where do they go?
I've heard of students sleeping in locker rooms overnight, and they don't even recognize themselves as homeless.
Then we hear from Oakland actor Don Reed as he takes us back to the 60s for his new one-man stage show.
He said, "Where'd you grow up?" I said, "I grew up in Oakland, and my stepfather was Jehovah's Witness, and my real father was a pimp." He said, "You need to do a one-man show about that."
And we'll take a closer look at one of the most visible political billboards in the Bay Area.
This is one of the few places, I guess, in this neighborhood that has a social conscience to it.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. The fall semester has just begun at colleges and universities across the Bay Area, which means hundreds of thousands of undergrads and grad students are squeezing themselves into the region's tight housing market right now. 75% of UC Berkeley undergrads live off campus. At SF State, it's much more than that. The wait lists for dorms are thousands of students long. So most of them are looking for rental housing, just like everyone else. With me now is KALW's housing reporter, Liza Veal, to talk about this. So Liza, how many students are we talking about?
So the biggest, UC Berkeley, has 40,000 undergrads, and only a quarter of them are in on-campus housing. San Francisco State has almost 30,000 and only houses a little over 4,000 of them. Mm-hmm. San Francisco's Academy of Art University has almost 13,000 students and houses less than 2,000 of them. I mean, there are dozens of other schools in the Bay Area, but most of them don't have any on-campus housing.
Okay, so the big obvious question, where are the rest of them living?
There are houses and apartments all over the place that market to students, but more and more, new graduates aren't passing down their rooms to younger students like they used to. Mm. They're staying put because they don't want to give up a good deal. Mm-hmm. I've seen new listings online that expect 8 students to share 4 bedrooms and each pay $1,000 a month, so $8,000 total for just a house. Mm-hmm. So students are definitely, they're sharing rooms, they're renting living rooms and basements, and they're just still paying way too much.
Okay, so that means for some students, their parents are paying way too much.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. And for students without parental support, I mean, it's nearly impossible to work enough to afford rent while keeping up with school. Mm-hmm. The UC Berkeley Student Association estimates that 11% of undergrads have or will experience homelessness at some point. Here's Taylor Harvey, who's the co-chair of the association and used to be homeless herself, in a video from the campus newspaper, The Daily Californian.
Students will sleep on couches of their friends, in cars, in libraries. I've heard of students sleeping in RSF, in locker rooms overnight, and they don't even recognize themselves as homeless.
So, Liza, 11% of Cal students are experiencing homelessness?
Yeah, and among Black first-generation college students, the figure shoots up to 18%. So, in the face of that, some students leave. Mm-hmm. SFSU officials say they know students are dropping out because they can't afford to live in the Bay Area.
So, City College of San Francisco just became tuition-free last year. That must help some students afford to live here.
Yeah, definitely. Most of those students are already locals, so their situation is different from a lot of this fall's incoming student renters, but they're still students trying to live in the city, so yeah.
So this is basically just the whole Bay Area's housing affordability problem just playing out with students.
Yes, but it's made worse because most of these schools, definitely Cal, are actually growing their enrollment.
Right.
UC Berkeley has grown by 13% in the last 5 years. There's pressure on the entire UC system to add students while cutting funding to make up for budget deficits.
Okay, but they're not adding new dorms.
Well, they're all beginning to do that now. San Francisco State says it has 9,000 new beds in the pipeline. UC Berkeley just opened up its first new dorm since 2012, and the chancellor has identified a bunch of possible sites to build more dorms. Although each of those sites is a struggle to get approval for.
Why?
Just because of opposition from the neighbors. Either they don't want a big, tall building and traffic, or they want to preserve what's there. Especially the most contentious one is People's Park, which is on the list. And it's a park with a lot of history. And homeless people have been sleeping there for decades. So mm-hmm. people are fighting to protect it.
Okay. So lots of considerations. I mean, maybe that's why building in Berkeley and San Francisco never happens
exactly.
quickly.
Exactly. It doesn't happen quickly. But so the quick fix that these schools, especially Cal, are resorting to is to lease private apartment buildings and rent them to students.
Uh-huh.
It's cheaper in the short term because you don't have to pay to have something built. But over the long term, it's really expensive because you're never paying the building off. And it's definitely more expensive for the students living in them. These private buildings are more like regular apartments than dorms. Mm-hmm. They don't come with meal plans, but the units are bigger. There's all these amenities like rooftop gardens and car shares.
But how much do they pay?
So they're paying about $1,500 or more a month. So in other words, this new leased housing is serving the more well-to-do students.
Okay. So what else is being done to address this issue?
Well, just last week, State Senator Nancy Skinner, who represents a district in the East Bay, passed a bill through the state legislature to help address the problem. So the new law will allow student housing developments to tap into this density bonus incentive, something that private developers use when they build low-income housing. So basically it means that they can build up to 35% more units in a building than they were previously allowed to.
And while we wait for all that construction to get done,
well, students at UC Berkeley formed a homeless student union, and they say the university has failed to provide emergency services to homeless students. So they're filling that gap by trying to connect students to shelters, and they're pushing for the university to create its own resources. So those ideas will probably spread to other schools in the Bay Area.
Okay. Thank you, Liza.
Thank you, Hannah.
Liza Veal is our housing reporter. You can reach her at housing@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland native Don Reed never planned on being a stage performer. He was in college on his way to becoming a chiropractor when a required class on public speaking renewed an old interest. He ended up winning tons of speech competitions and eventually entering the world of stand-up comedy. After years in the entertainment industry as a television actor and voiceover talent, Don turned to more personal material, spinning stories about his family and life growing up in East Oakland into a trio of successful solo shows. His latest is called Can You Dig It? The 60s, and it's up at the Marsh in Berkeley right now. Don came to KLW Studios to tell us more about his journey to the stage.
My name is Don Reed, and I'm an actor, writer, performer. Everybody called me Blinky as a kid because I had a lot of tics and habits. I blink. I had tics with my mouth, clicks with my tongue. I would move my head back and forth. And so it created a major distraction in terms of people just regularly interacting and communicating with me. But then I wouldn't do it while I was giving the speeches. It was just like, for some reason, it was gone. And then after I was done, it'd come back, particularly when girls walked up and like, hi, I'm like, oh my God, I'm nervous again. Blink, 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 blink. My first experience with public speaking was connected to the congregation in that religion that rhymes with Jehovah's Witnesses. When I first started going door to door, which is quite a challenge, you know, knocking on a complete stranger's door and trying to share your message with them. But then later on, they informed us we also had to give speeches in the congregation, full length, 7 to 10 minute speeches, you on stage by yourself, an organized speech with a clear beginning, middle, and end. I'm like, I've never done this. Giving my first speech, it turned out great. And there was a byproduct, because I was just coming into, I think I just made like maybe 13 or something. The byproduct of it was that afterwards, all the girls in the congregation said, oh, that was so good. I was like, oh my God. In the 10th grade, I took a biology course, and there was a test on anatomy, human anatomy, and I got 100%. I memorized every muscle and bone in the human body. And so at the time I was living like 83rd and East 14th, you know, Hard Brothers, Tay-Tay, Junebug, all of them. And I would blow their minds that I knew all the scientific name for parts of it. And they would encircle me and say, "He know all the science name of everything on your body. Tell us." And I'd stand there in a circle pointing at different body parts. Orbicularis, ocularis, oris, biceps, femoris, pectoralis, external major, oblique, metacarpals, metatarsals, phalanges. Oh my God, phalanges. These is called phalanges. So it was kind of exciting being able to get that information. I was in junior college at Chabot College in Hayward. When I started at Chabot College, a prerequisite course was public speaking. And I got in the speech class, and of course, from all that door knocking and speeches, I killed it. So the instructor said, "I don't think you're a chiropractor. I don't think you're a doctor. I think you're an entertainer." I was like, "No." She said, "No, I think you're a comedian and an actor." I was like, "What?" But she convinced me to go to one speech tournament, did well there, got on the team, and then I was just hooked. I ended up going to tons of tournaments around the Bay Area. And then we made it to state, and then we went to nationals. And then when I was at nationals, a bunch of colleges saw me in UCLA, said, "Hey, speech and debate here at UCLA." And that's how I ended up at UCLA. I was winning like the comedy events, and they said, "Are you gonna do stand up?" I was like, I hadn't totally thought about it. I know I wanted to. And I tried to do a comedy speech one time at the Punchline in San Francisco, and I died the death of 100 men. But the cool thing is a friend went with me. I'd already done really well at the tournaments, but I tried to do my organized speech with a beginning, middle, and end, and a thesis statement at the comedy club where people were smoking and drinking back in the day. That did not go fantastic, but a friend was with me when I died, and we left, and we got on BART. And we wrote, he didn't say a word to me from the walk to the ride for like 20 minutes or so. And then he said, "Oh my God, you are horrible." And we started dying laughing. And that was the key, that I laughed real hard at it going poorly. And then thereafter, anytime it went wrong, and it didn't go wrong like a lot, but when it did go wrong, when I did die, it was more like, "Ooh, I stunk up the room." And it was funny. Well, I did stand up for years, and I made a really good living at it, particularly at this job that people don't really know exists, and that's an audience warm-up opening act for network television shows. So at the live taping of a TV show, any show, there's a comedian that makes everybody laugh before the show actually starts. So I did a lot of audience warm-up. I did a lot of stand-up on the road, opening and headlining at a lot of comedy clubs across the country. But I was always doing stuff that was kind of manufactured. Impersonations, doing Sammy Davis Jr. singing a Jay-Z song or whatever, just whatever it was that was like kind of manufactured, but nothing about myself, because I didn't want to talk about the tough religion time, and I didn't want to discuss my father's outlaw pimp background. I was like, let's leave that out. But even as I was doing these shows, I was still reserving some big chunks of the truth. Looking back at it now, I can kind of have a better perspective on how we perceive what is like a big, big, big challenge, or what's kind of scary or supposed to be scary. Years later, I was working at NBC, and this one guy that was working there was working on a solo show. He said, "I'm working on a solo show." I said, "What is it about?" He's like, "About my Jewish parents on my back about, you know, won't I keep a real job, forget about trying to be a comedian or a writer and all that kind of stuff." He said, "Where'd you grow up?" I said, "I grew up in Oakland, and my stepfather was Jehovah's Witness, and my real father was a pimp." He said, "You need to do a one-man show about that." So I wrote it in 99, but I didn't perform it until 2006. But even as I was doing these shows, I was still reserving some big chunks of the truth. Was aware that I knew I was telling a lot, but there was some tough, tough stuff that I was kind of leaving out. And it wasn't until 2016 that I stepped beyond and added those other layers, and then boom, it really has changed my life. I told a story called I Miss Tony about my brother who became my sister. And it was the hardest thing I ever did. And by telling that story, that level of vulnerability made me unafraid to do anything else. So anytime someone called me about a meeting in Los Angeles or going to meet some executives, that whole scared heartbeat, nervous thing went away. And I'm like, well, nothing's harder than doing that. Now, through performing this work and tapping on elements of some of that OCD behavior, some of the tics, the habits, the counting, I've been made free of a lot of that stuff. Through creating these solo shows, in particular the trilogy that's autobiographical, I've learned that little me didn't have to be so scared. Little Donnie didn't have to be so terrified about what was going on around him. I had a lot of time that I spent not telling this truth, and by diving into it, it's made me the bravest I've ever been.
That was actor Don Reed. You can catch him this weekend through September 9th performing his one-man show, Can You Dig It? The 60s at the Marsh in Berkeley. Find all the details at kalw.org. That piece was produced by Tarek Foda. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. These days, it's hard to escape from politics. Out in Oakland, one man is leaning in and putting his thoughts right up front. And after nearly two decades of doing this, he purchased his medium in August for $3.75 million and can't wait to start renovations and put it in the National Register of Historic Places. What is this place? KLW's Ryan Miller takes us there.
Just northeast of Lake Merritt, across the 580 freeway, you really can't miss it.
It's very public. I know that I see it every day coming home from work.
There's a variety of messages. This is one of the few places, I guess, in this neighborhood that has such kind of has some social conscience to it.
Yes, I do recall some inflammatory political messages, all very left, throughout the years.
From my apartment window, I can actually see the Grand Lake neon signs.
This is Alan Michon. I've been the operator of the Grand Lake Theater since 1980. And I started posting political messages on the marquee on the day that the so-called Supreme Court stopped the counting of votes in Florida in 2000. The first message was, "This is America. Every vote should be counted."
We're in Michon's office in Alameda. We're looking at photos of, I don't know if they're all the messages that ever appeared on the marquee, but many, hundreds of them anyway. How many do you think there have been?
I have no idea. At least a few hundred.
Okay, so let's go through a few of these. And I know you also sometimes are very local.
Some of the local things we've talked about are the parking issues. As far as nationally, we railed against the war constantly. Here's a good one. Truth is to the Bush administration as sunlight is to Dracula.
But the majority of the marquee messages have a single focus.
One of the big issues that I have focused on over the years with the marquee is to point out that American elections are absolutely fraudulent. And I am extremely concerned about the fact that the use of electronic voting machines and electronic tabulation of votes has destroyed the freedom of the citizens of this country.
So Michon has a very big, very visible platform to broadcast his political opinions. And what does the city of Oakland think about that?
The city is in no way wanting to curtail the public's right to free speech, and that marquee is one venue for doing so.
Scott Miller works with the city of Oakland's Planning and Building Department, which regulates signage.
What it says is, is really not within the purview of zoning to dictate. We don't dictate what some business owner should say about their business. We just define parameters for size, and we do not deal with the content.
So, what do you need to know before putting up your own political poster or flyer?
Those generally would fall under the special sign category, and there really is no code spelled out.
Miller thumbs through his document of zoning regulations adopted in the early 1990s.
The code provides some discretion. The allowance says special signs shall be limited to the area of display surface, number, location, and height, and kind of mobility, illumination, and material that are customarily and necessary to the purposes they serve. So,
are you following this?
That's a lot of bureaucratic gobbledygook. I don't know if the city's ever been sort of forced to indicate exactly what that means, but it certainly allows some flexibility, and it would probably, if called upon, allow the city to apply some discretion.
In Oakland, for signs relating to elections, regulations require that they not go up more than 90 days before the vote, nor stay up more than 10 days after the vote. And they can't be bigger than 32 square feet. But according to Miller, given limited city resources, compliance is not heavily enforced anyway, unless there are a lot of complaints. That hasn't happened yet to Alan Michon at the Grand Lake.
Another one, in a true democracy, the president is elected by counting votes and winning.
So, Alan, tell us how you really feel.
Well, I think I've said it.
In big, bold, block letters, in Oakland, I'm Ryan Miller for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in the fall of 2015, and now fans of the Grand Lake Theater can rest easy. It's staying put. You can hear the best of Cross Currents anytime by subscribing to the Cross Currents podcast. Do it at KALW.org and click Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Muna Danish, Janae Darden, Ninegensler Debs, Nicholas Harder, Sarah Coast, Angela Johnston, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Celine Ross, Josh Wilson, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is Jen Chien, and our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Encore une fois, tu te trouves là. This music is by Rupa and the April Fishes from San Francisco. They're performing at the Oakland Museum of California this Friday night. Show starts at 7. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Regarde-moi, ici au bout d'un souffle.